While people are thinking of their questions, Paul, can I just ask you your observations about Victoria and Australia in terms of our business context on your various visits here?
I get asked this a lot. My experience, and I deal with businesses in most places in the world, I like to come here because the conversation around sustainability in business is advanced. Now, you may look at that and say, well, we don't feel that way, but it actually is. I mean, you have Sustainability Victoria, you have part of the EPA now that's intent on trying to help businesses become sustainable. Organizations like PACI are looking at what leadership looks like in this area. And so I see quite a lot of movement. Now, having said that, nowhere in the world has the action really started to move like it needs to. If you look at the statistics, 60% of the world's ecosystems are degraded or being used unsustainably today. 60% of the world's population lives on less than $5 a day. And so I think the intent is being put in place, and I see more action here than I do in most places in the world. Most people look at Scandinavia as kind of the center for leadership. I was up in Denmark this summer, and I was on a cruise ship, and we came into Copenhagen, and you see the windmills, and all of a sudden you think you're in the center of environmentalism. And then you, right behind it, you see the big coal-fired power plant chugging away. And so there's a lot of talk in this that the thing to do now is to translate it into actions that actually help your businesses while improving the environment and societal values.
Eric Lichtenmatt from Melbourne Water. I'm interested in the purity of the slogan of zero. You said no increasing zero or in energy by a certain point of time. How does renewable energy fit into that? Does that get debited out somehow, or can it be part of that total energy which you're not trying to...
The renewable energy is not part of that achievement, but we do have a goal that we set for 2010 as a company to have 10% renewable energy. Now, let me explain the tagline on it. The tagline is it costs competitive to fossil fuels. It's not at an added cost. And today, DuPont has 6% renewable energy and is saving $15 million a year. Now, you say, how do you do that? And we get 1% total corporate energy from landfills. You simply go to landfills that are venting methane, and you capture it, and you put it into your plant and displace natural gas. Turns out we get it at 75% of the cost of natural gas. So renewables can play a big part of this. But it's just evolving. The thought is it has to be more expensive. I would say let's not make it more expensive.
Hamish Hughes from Oz Industry. With the modern trend for senior management in publicly listed companies to be very pressured towards extreme short-term results, quarterly, half-yearly, etc., how do you counteract that with trying to show them the long-term benefits of more sustainable policies that might have short-term costs?
That's a terrifically good question. It almost always comes up.
Paul, I just remind you, I'm judging the questions.
Okay. That was an average question. Better than mediocre, but average. You got to remember, when I talk about sustainability, my intent is to do it in a different way than many people do. I believe you have to create environmental and societal values up front in your business process, not at the end. It's always a cost at the end. Up front in your R&D, your business strategy planning, your marketing strategies, in a way that improves your financial bottom line. Now, business always invests for future benefits, so some of these things take time. But I learned when I was down here once a concept called runs on the board. And so when you get a dozen things that you can do in this area, you ought to pick a few you can do right away. I was in a meeting with a company yesterday that said they had tens of millions of dollars they could save in energy. And they had set a goal to save 10%. And I said, is this difficult? He said, this is the low-hanging fruit. So I think you need to have a combination of both. Just like you run a business, you have near-term things and you have longer-term things. But don't view the money you invest as a cost. It's an investment if you're doing it for a longer-term change.
Hi, Paul. One of the debates, I guess, that's raging at the moment is about the value of reporting and whether companies should mandatorily report. I'd be interested to hear your take on on reporting and whether it's had value as a process?
I'm a big fan of reporting if it forces you to collect information that you need to have to make good decisions. I'm not a big fan to do it because you get on somebody's checklist. You may do it for that reason. DuPont had a wonderful sustainable growth progress report because our employees were hugely interested in the progress we were making. We made it shorter every year. We found out most people like to know whether things are going up or going down. So we had pictures and stories and graphs. We got it down to a little fold-out that we could give to our customers. What a wonderful thought. Give it to our customers. And then along came the Global Reporting Initiative, which is a 50-page report, and we stopped the short one, and we put all the data up on the Internet on a site. You know how many hits we get? We get the check. How many hits do we get? None. Now, fortunately, we put all that information in the DuPont annual report, which is where it ought to be anyway. And so it's throughout the annual report, which I think is the right place to be. So the answer is I think reports have value in getting information, allowing you to know where impacts are, working on things. But think about the audience. We found the number one audience for our reporting was really our employees. They really wanted to know, particularly when you're number one villain. They want to know what you're doing because their families live in the communities and they hear these stories and they'd like to have some information. I would say the number two audience ought to be your customers because there are tremendous things you can do with your customers, simplify supply chains, do all sorts of things. But the external environmental community wants to be able to check you off a list, and I'm just being honest with my opinion of that.
Thank you. Catherine Walt from Australia Post. I was just interested, I guess I'm going to double my chances for the pen by asking a two-pronged question. And that is, firstly, it's a great story that you've got to tell and very inspirational. But I'd like to hear a couple of the war stories about how you did have to convince people and how they weren't easily convinced. And secondly, reflecting on my role, having an HR role, if there was some internal performance management system to say, okay, if you don't want to come along, we're going to make you come along by putting it into some performance management measurement.
After being here in Australia, I started to write a book because I was inspired by what I saw here, but I thought I'd make it Australian. So I told some people, one of the chapters is called Lost in Bendigo, which is a true story. But one of the chapters is called Red Dots, Yellow Dots, Green Dots. It's about people. Very few people that work in this field have a people strategy. I'm not talking about getting in the KPIs. I'm talking about how you develop people in your organization. I was very interested in John's comments on the young leaders work you're doing. To what extent are you bringing young leaders into this area early? And by the way, my preferred place for sustainability people is in marketing, R&D and operations, not in the sustainability department. What I'd like to see them do is bring their sustainability interests and capabilities into the mainstream of how business works. So I think it's very important to have a plan. Now, you get three types of people in companies. The red dots, you know those? Could care less about this. The yellow dots, which is the big group in companies that watch both ends of the spectrum. And the green dots, I got it. Okay. Now, the green dots are dangerous if they haven't got good reasons for getting it. They're just off there going. The red dots are really important because they ask all the questions. Most of them are financial in nature. And so it forces an integrity in this. So all of these types of people are important. If you're for sustainability in your company, you ought to watch what you do to promote people. Remember, the yellow dots watch both ends. If you promote a green, what happens? But if you've got a big sustainability vision and you promote a red, what happens? The integrity gets lost. So I'm a huge fan. And I don't want to convert anybody. I want the bottom line to demonstrate how good this can be for business. That's a good question. That's an average question.
Paul, I have about 1,000 questions, but I'll just pick two below average questions. One of them is both your country and our country have refused to ratify the Kyoto Agreement, and I'm just interested in any comments you might have on that particular issue. The second one just draws on the previous question. I'd be interested in what DuPont itself is doing to develop people with the kind of mindset that you're talking about.
Oh, good. I love that. That's about an hour discussion, but that's my favorite subject. Nobody really wants to spend time getting into that subject, but I think it's critical. The answer to the first is very interesting. I was telling John after I spoke that for the first couple of years of my life in the job I worked in at DuPont when I retired, I got questions from reporters about waste and emissions. Everybody wanted to know about toxic stuff. 1995, when we established the goal of zero for waste, we put an end to the argument of where we stood. And Greenpeace took us off their list. Everything changed. But the really important thing was somebody asked the story about the Corian pen, and it got on the business page of the Washington Post. Changed my life. But the story that I spent most of the latter part of my career talking about was greenhouse gas emissions. In 1991, when I was running the petrochemicals business, I had a small 15-minute meeting with about three people. And we'd been the number one CFC producers, and we were linked to ozone depletion, but we had developed an understanding of atmospheric science, and we knew climate change was real and linked to greenhouse gases. So we didn't make any announcements. We just said we're going to do some projects. So we spent $50 million and reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 72%. Now you say, how does that coincide with the 7%? We had a lot of non-CO2 gases. Now, if we stop there, this would be an environmental story. And I like business stories, so we got involved in helping create emission trading systems. And we went to Canada, then to the UK, helped them develop their system. And a few years ago, we sold $50 million worth of credits into the system. And we're just starting. We're now in China helping reduce fluorochemical emissions with our technologies. Now, we do not endorse Kyoto, to answer your question. And the reason is it's not enough, the process isn't right, on and on and on. But we do endorse reducing greenhouse gas emissions, so that's where we stand. Number one question I got from reporters is, what do you think of the Bush administration position? They were trying to pick a fight. And I tell them, we're for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The second I'll give a really short answer to, if anybody wants to stay around and talk about this, thinking through a people plan starts with not only your young people, but your leadership. And a lot of the strategies I would use is to get our leadership on their feet to talk to somebody about what we were doing. Get them out publicly to speeches, help them with the writing of the speeches and stuff. I made great friends with a corporate speechwriter. In fact, we got into one of the speeches, a 10% renewable goal, a flat energy goal, and a 70% reduction in greenhouse gas goal. It wasn't a policy decision, it was a speech. Now, what happens when a leader in a company gets up and gives a public speech? Is it voluntary? The US EPA gave us lots of opportunities. They had waste-wise, climate-wise, voluntary programs. We signed up for them all. And I'll just forgive me for going on, but I only once had to use a stick, and this is where Terry comes in. We were getting close to 2000, and we had committed to the US EPA a 40% reduction. Now, 70% is what we did globally, 40% in the US. And on Friday afternoon, I went into one of the business leaders that was critical of this, and he said he wasn't going to do it. This was a corporate thing. He wasn't going to do it. He said, go home, have a drink, forget it. So I called his boss, and Monday morning, we showed up in his office. And he ended up doing it. In fact, he reduced the emissions in a way he had more saleable product. And so occasionally the stick is very, very important. But my preferred approach with leadership in companies is to get them engaged, get them active, get them to tell a story, get them to commit. Okay?
Title as to how corporate environmental and social reputation can improve your bottom line, I understand is a seductive approach that is designed to get people to realise the importance of it. But I wonder about the dangers of that approach. There are plenty of ways of improving one's bottom line, of course. And is the title of your talk perhaps indicative of how difficult it is to convince people of the intrinsic arguments for corporate environmental and social responsibility?
Absolutely. Corporate and social responsibility has taken on an air of being a separate subject. And the way I tried to talk about it here is your reputation is based on what you do, not what you say. And so you only get so far by saying it. When we set the goal of zero in place, people didn't go away. They wanted to see us make progress. The difference between being the villain and the hero was simply the progress we made. It was as simple as that. The best people to tell that story, by the way, is not DuPont. So we invited in over time probably 60 or 70 NGOs to participate in judging our Sustainable Growth Excellence Awards. And they heard all the stories. Now, who becomes your best advocates? Who tells your story for you better than you do? Now, we didn't design the system that way. But some of these people give speeches all over the world, and if they have a few examples of things that are going good, it does wonders for your reputation. But reputation is built on doing things, I think.
Thanks, Paul. My name's Paul Christofani, and I'm the relatively newly appointed Sustainable Development Manager at Geelong Shell Refinery.
Oh, good.
I really enjoyed your presentation, and I enjoyed your workshop in a separate context a couple of years ago where you went through a lot more detail. I'm interested in the operational aspects. Sustainable development, I make a distinction between SD and sustainability, particularly for an industry that's based on utilisation of fossil fuel resources for the most part. The contributions made in social and environmental under a sustainable development banner are a lot easier. Not that they're easy, but they're a lot easier to rationalise and discuss than something along the lines of sustainability. But on an operational level, Paul, if you were to come to the Geelong refinery, and I threw this question to Amory Lovins back in 2000, and in the context of the suboptimality of engineering systems, knowing what we know now versus 50 or 60 years ago when a lot of our key infrastructure was built, means that we've inherited things that, to a large extent, are beyond our control. And Amory wasn't, unfortunately, able to give me much of an answer that was practical. But if I, hypothetically, Paul, invited you to our Geelong refinery and sat you down with the engineers and the management team, would you be able to point to two practical, implementable learnings that we could start on?
If you give me half a day to understand what you're trying to do, I try to put it in a matrix. And on one side of the matrix are environmental values and societal values. And on the top of the matrix are the top two or three business objectives you have for the refinery or the business. It's a very simple matrix. And the question is, to what extent are the programs and projects you're working on fit in that matrix? What we have in this field of sustainability is a whole bunch of fluff. We have stuff that costs huge amounts of money, and it's called sustainability, and there's no benefit. But there are a unique set of projects and programs that create environmental and societal values and serve your business. Double revenues, cut costs, improve return on invested capital. And the real challenge is to find those, and where you have blanks, fill in new projects that do it. So I'd need some time to work with you, but I think every organization I've worked with has several of these. They just have several of them. Is that an invitation?
It's open-ended. We'll talk later.
I'll give you one side subject. One of the things we've talked a lot about in this visit is water. Water is different than energy. Energy has an elasticity to it. Water seems to be the same price until you don't have it, so it's a different subject. And I'm trying to wrestle with how you put that into the business context, and the best I can do, and it relates to this question, is if you were to expand, or let's say you were to build a new facility and you said you're going to use 80% less water, you'd probably size your pipes and your pumps differently. But once you have these big pipes and pumps, you have them. So a lot of it's getting up front and figuring out how to make things smaller by using less water, less energy. And then you have that for the entire time you run your facility. That's just kind of the type of thinking I'd like to see happen.
Time for one last question.
Mary Jane Crabtree from Allens Arthur Robinson, a law firm. The examples that you gave in your presentation were fantastic. They're really inspiring. They're about people having great ideas and carrying them through to commercialisation. We're often told in Australia that we have great training, we have great people, great ideas. A lot of it goes offshore. I just wondered whether you had any ideas or suggestions about how, as a nation, we can get into the latest stages of bringing our ideas to fruition and you know, getting some of the benefits of them.
Well, I've been in a couple of meetings. One was on prescribed industrial waste, and I was in a room with about 9 companies, and every one of them had a great idea of what to do. And all it was required was to get the right environment and somebody to facilitate the discussion. Yesterday we met with 8 companies plus the City of Melbourne representatives in a thing called the Business Transformer. And essentially everybody in that room had good ideas that fit in this matrix I was just describing. All they needed was the kind of the framework and the... So I don't think it's an idea, lacking of ideas. I think that it's the encouragement to get on with getting these things placed. And once they get placed in the business plan, they get done. Once they get placed in the sustainability plan, maybe they get done. So my preference is to get it in the business plan. And then everybody pulls together to make it work. And today, most of that's not happening. It tends to be a separate subject. So let's get it hardlined. And then business will do it because it just is the best thing they can do for the business.